The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, happy Halloween. I was saying earlier that I had wished that, well, I did. I looked for, like, okay, can I find something interesting that has, like, skeletons or pumpkins? Or I wasn't successful. So, instead, I have a little bit of a teaching that has a little bit of language that's unusual, and maybe it's okay for Halloween. This is a little bit of a story. It's a short story. So, and this is kind of like my paraphrasing, sprinkling in some of the actual language. So at one time, the Buddha, he went on alms round, right? This is, the Buddha, of course, did this every day. This is how he got his meals. And the monks, they would all go at the same time. That was part of the rules of being a monastic, is that you couldn't go on alms just willy-nilly whenever you wanted to, because that would be bothersome for the community members. So they just wanted the community members to kind of know, okay, the monastics show up around this time. And so that it would be not troubling for them. So the Buddha, while he was walking for alms near the cattle-yoking fig tree, so a tree that they would tie cows to, and he saw a monk who was not satisfied, was not gratified, was not having enjoyment. So I'm not sure what a cattle-yoking fig tree is, but we can imagine that's a place where a lot of cattle get tied. Maybe it's a lot of manure. Maybe it's a place where it would be like a market where they would sell cattle. Maybe it's a place where merchants would go and potential buyers would go, and, you know, maybe. Or maybe, I mean, I don't know, maybe there was even like a butchering was done there too. Like, do you want this one? Okay. And they would do some butchering there. I don't know. But the reason I'm bringing this up is you can imagine, so it's alms round, so that means the monastics have their bowl, and they're going out looking for lunch, and here's one monk who finds himself at the cattle-yoking fig tree, and maybe it's not a pleasant place if you're not going to buy a cow. So maybe it's a place that where, so he is feeling dissatisfied and uncomfortable. Maybe it smells really bad. There's a manure around. So the Buddha sees this monk who's not satisfied, gratified, or having enjoyment. And this monk was seeking gratification, seeking satisfaction, seeking enjoyment outwardly. So was trying to just find out, so there's got to be something here that's going to feel better, going to help me feel better, have a little bit of sense of well-being or ease. So not only was he looking out there for something to somehow satisfy him, the description is that he was forgetting mindfulness. And he was, Bhikkhu Bodhi, the primary translator, he uses this expression, and this monk was muddle-minded. I like this word, muddle-minded. So not having clarity or being foggy, maybe something like this. And another place in the suttas, this gets augmented a little bit and says that people who are muddle-minded or forgetful of whatever they have just done. And, you know, kind of forgetting, not only are they not mindful, but they are just absent-minded, let's say that. So this monk was also without clear awareness, which other places signifies like without wisdom, was not concentrated, and was like a ship cast about by a fierce current. So, you know, not collected, not settled, and instead being susceptible to kind of some of the blowing winds or the currents of what was happening. So, also this monk had a wandering mind. Bhikkhu Bodhi uses this expression, was scatterbrained. And elsewhere it describes this as like being foolish deer on a road. Right? They didn't have deer in the headlights back then, but we can imagine, like, well, you know, kind of this frightening, like, oh, what do I do, right, when you find yourself and something's coming towards you and some confusion and not sure what to do. And then the last descriptor of this monk wasn't restraining his senses. That is, he was like trying to see or hear, maybe taste or touch, and things that were going to bring some satisfaction, going to bring some enjoyment, bring some ease. I kind of love this description. It's kind of, I speak for myself, but I think it's part of the human condition. We get a little crazed when things are just so not the way that we want them to be. Can you imagine like going to have lunch and the waiter says, okay, well, here's your seat, and you're in the middle of a manure pile or something like this, right? And you feel like, oh, get me out of here. Like, where else? I wish I were somewhere else. What else can I do? Where else can I be? Not being able to be settled. Not being able to kind of just be with what is. Having this fidgety, agitated, maybe is the right word, really agitated. So the Buddha goes up to this monk. He sees him and he says, monk, do not sully yourself. We'll talk about this a little bit in a minute. And then the Buddha continues, it is inevitable that flies will pursue and attack one who has sullied himself and one who has been tainted by a stench. And the monk, oh, okay, so the Buddha comes and talks to me. And then being thus exhorted by the Buddha, thus being encouraged to practice, thus being taught by the Buddha, the monk underwent samvega. Samvega is a Pali word. It's a little bit difficult to translate. I'll spend a little bit of time talking about it. But I still kind of want to set up this scene so that there's this monk who is agitated, certainly not practicing mindfulness, not practicing concentration. And then the most senior person comes up to him and says, don't sully yourself, don't pollute yourself, don't taint yourself, don't tarnish yourself. And then he goes on to say, because flies will pursue and attack one who has sullied themselves and has been tainted by a stench. It's kind of, this is like really harsh language. It's very, it's not flowery, or maybe it's flowery in some kind of way, but flowers smell good, whereas this is kind of pointing to something that doesn't smell good. So I'll come back to this, I'll flesh this out, what the Buddha is talking about. We're talking about pollution and stench and flies. But first I want to talk about samvega. So what was this monk's response? I mean, I heard this from the Buddha. So, as I mentioned, it's a kind of a difficult word to translate. Tanisara Bhikkhu Tonjeff, who comes here and teaches on occasion, and we have some of his books over there, he describes samvega is what the Buddha to be, the person who was going to become the Buddha but wasn't yet a Buddha. We could call him Siddhartha. What Siddhartha felt. Samvega. Siddhartha felt samvega on his first exposure, the first time he encountered, the first time he saw old age, sickness, and death. So probably many of you are familiar with this legend of the story of the Buddha's life and the quest for his enlightenment. Briefly, so when he was young, I'll call him Siddhartha. He lived in this complete ignorance of kind of these elementary facts of human life, that people get old, they become sick, and they die. Maybe not even in that order. And the legend has it that his father wanted to protect him, this very sensitive son, from all exposure to suffering. So he kind of kept him like captive in these beautiful, opulent palaces. Just kind of like incarcerated in this sense of splendor. And there, this Siddhartha, he didn't have any idea that there was anything except this endless succession of pleasurable activities. His whole entire life was that. That was all that he saw. Filled with amusement, filled with festivities, filled with, maybe we could use the word distractions, but maybe he didn't even feel like he needed to be distracted. So, and then when Siddhartha was 29, the legend goes, he went outside the palace. There's a story around this, but there he encountered an old person, a sick person, and a corpse. And he had this like this shocking truth, like, wow, is this what happens when people get old? Is this what sickness looks like? I think the legend has it that he saw somebody that was, the description is they're bent way over and, you know, and stumbling along, so no longer able to stand up straight, and to see a corpse. So samvega, when is this feeling that often it's associated after seeing death, after seeing some tragedy or some unexpected difficulty. It can also be in response to something beautiful and deeply meaningful, but it's something that kind of shocks us out of our usual perception, out of our usual way of considering our life, out of considering the world. And it puts our life in a different perspective, changes our priorities. And Tanisiro Biko, he says there's like these three clusters of feelings that kind of that go together with samvega. One is this sense of shock, this sense of dismay, that sense of alienation that comes with realizing, oh, things are really, really different than I thought they were. That it's not, I just was kind of busy living a life this way, and it sometimes comes as a shock, like, wow, it's actually not that way. That's the first feeling. The second, Tanjeff describes as a chastening sense of our own complacency and our foolishness, like, well, how did I not know this before? It's now that I'm sensitive to it, I see it's obvious everywhere, and what have I been doing with my life that I haven't really been tuned into this? And then the third part of this feeling of samvega is this sense of urgency, this sense of wanting to find a way in which to find some ease, some diminishment, some escape from this feeling, from the realization of how much that we're going to die. Of course, this is a story that's, you know, placed thousands of years ago, but this gets played out every day, right? When we all know that our loved ones are going to die. We all know that we're going to die. But sometimes it's not until someone close to us actually dies that's a little bit of a wake-up call. A little bit. Maybe it's a giant wake-up call. Or maybe we've had a near-death experience that's beautiful. And that also is kind of a wake-up call, kind of a reorientation. Maybe a diagnosis kind of helps shift things. There's lots of stories of this in contemporary times. So this feeling of samvega is a little bit of a wake-up call, but it has with it a sense of movement, like I want to do something now with this. I want to live my life a particular way. And of course, in the Buddhist stories, samvega is associated with a kind of a wish for a sincerity of practice. So this story continues. So the Buddha, after his alms round, maybe before I go there, I'll say this. So this monk, standing perhaps in the midst of a bunch of manure and trying desperately to find some way to feel better, the Buddha comes over and talks to him, and he has a little bit of a wake-up call. Maybe he didn't realize how scattered he was, how kind of crazed he was. And he has this, just with hearing these words, has a renewed commitment to practice. Maybe it's not even renewed. Maybe it's for the first time. So then the Buddha goes back, after this alms round, he goes back and he tells the story exactly as it was. I saw this monk who was standing there and I told him, don't sully yourself, for flies will attack somebody who has tainted themselves with stench. And so there's another monk. I imagine he's kind of raising his hand and says, Venerable Sir, what is meant by sully? And what do you mean by stench? And what are the flies? So the Buddha responds, filled with longing is what is meant by sullying or tarnishing, spoiling, tainting, maybe ruining, polluting, defiling, these types of words, is to be filled with longing. Ill will is the stench. And unskillful, unwholesome, unhelpful thoughts are the flies. So I'd like to unpack this a little bit. So longing, this kind of, sometimes it's translated as covetousness or maybe even greed, this desperately wanting something, has its roots in when there's a sense of lack, when there's a sense of something's definitely missing and you want something and you feel this dissatisfaction, which certainly fit the case of this monk in this story. It's often paired with just a general sense of discontent. There's this sense of, I'm discontent and I want to be content. There's a longing for that. But it has a, like it can feel like a sticky or feeling of being entangled. Yeah, I definitely had this feeling not too long ago when through my own fault, I had to be someplace and left a little bit late. And you know, I'm going to talk about traffic, right? Because this is such a common part of our lives here in the Bay Area. But when the traffic got bad, I just found myself like, oh, I just looking at the clock and like, am I going to get there? And I just couldn't quite find this equilibrium or equanimity or some steadiness in the midst of having this difficulty with this wish that the traffic weren't the way that it was. But it was. It was the way that it was. And maybe that wouldn't be so bad, except that what often comes with, they're very often paired, both in our experience and in the suttas and it describes them, this sense of longing, this covetousness, a little bit of greed. It often goes together with a little bit, or maybe a lot, of ill will. Get out of my way! Don't you guys realize I'm in a hurry? This is kind kind of like, it's not a movement of generosity. It's not a movement of love and tenderness. It's like everything that's like thwarting what one wants gets spray painted with this feeling of, you know, I don't know, go away. It's you're bothersome. There's something that's a feeling of pushing away. Maybe I don't have to describe it. I think all of us have this experience, a result of some frustrated desire that we want. And so one thing that happens is that when we have this longing or this wish for something, that there can be a kind of like a narrowing down, a closing, a collapsing of our attention, of our awareness. And then we can like narrow into, oh, this thing right here is the problem. If only this thing went away. If only this thing, this person, this institution, this system, this object, we can kind of like narrow in and focus on and think like, okay, this is the problem. I have to get rid of this, right? This is this feeling of ill will, like go away. I have to take care of that, make that go away. So we have this assumption that if we just somehow eliminate that one car that's in the fast lane, that's going slow, that's making all the rest of us not being able to go the right speed, or that one person who is at the stoplight still busily texting and doesn't realize that the light has changed, or that one person at work who talks the whole so much during the meetings. So this sense of ill will often arises in connected to this sense of discontent, which also kind of the sense of longing. But it also gets fueled, it gets augmented, it gets supported by some unwise attention. That is that, I'm sure you've noticed this experience too, that once the ill will has arisen in the mind tends to return again and again to this issue. Well, if only this thing would go away, if only this thing would be different, if only this event, only this person. And so the irritation kind of like fuels additional ill will, and we find ourselves kind of stuck in a loop, just revisiting again and again. It's a little bit like, I mean, when you have a toothache, and you can't help but to always be like with your tongue touching the toothache. Like, I gotta go to the dentist, okay? But you can't, it's like nearly impossible to not be probing that, that ache is still there. Oh, okay, it's still there. We just somehow return it again and again. We are kind of, our attention collapses. So, once ill will has arisen, because we have frustrated desire, it often gets fueled by just not paying it, by allowing ourselves to just revisit again and again and again the sense of frustration or irritation. But when it's up, it has consequences. Of course it does. It will colors our perceptions, more likely to interpret things in a, maybe give nefarious intentions to people when that may not be accurate, but when we're in the midst of ill will. It colors our own intentions, our desires, our quests, what we're going to when we're filled with ill will. We have ideas of, we feel like we want to do. Our thoughts that float through the mind are different than when we're having thoughts filled with compassion and loving kindness. And when ill will is there, of course, it promotes action and supports that we do things that perhaps are unwise. I know this was many years ago when I was working in a laboratory and kind of research laboratories or like small communities, in the sense that there's like big equipment that everybody like shares, and then everybody has, you know, for the small equipment we have our own. And I was having difficulties with one of the other persons in the laboratory. And, we spend all day, every day, right, just in this laboratory. No windows, just stuck out there. And one day I found that, we don't eat or drink. I was a biochemist, so in there you don't have any food. You don't eat or drink anything in those laboratories. So there's lots of like little break rooms and other places. And I found this person that I was having a lot of difficulty with. I found his coffee cup in a really odd place, like in some strange place of in the building. I know it was his because it had his name on it, So I thought, if I just move this a little bit, it'll be next to impossible to find this coffee cup. So I moved it. This is quite some time ago, but wow. I was fascinated by the next few weeks. Every time, like, anything wasn't quite right, I thought, like, oh, he's getting me back because I moved his coffee mug. this ill will had just made me interpret every little thing, like, where's my calculator? Oh, I bet he took it. Where's my this? I'm sure that this person did that. You know, somehow kind of like acting this out and discolored my perceptions, my ideas about everything. Of course he didn't take my calculator. I was just had left it somewhere else, and of course he didn't. None of these things were attributed to him, but I was just interpreting things this way. This was before I was a practitioner, before I even heard about Buddhism. But that really struck me. This was such a powerful lesson. Just doing this little thing, this that was very ungenerous, and then how I just started to interpret everything differently. So we have ill will, kind of promotes unwise actions. And it obstructs clear seeing. We don't see actually what's happening. Instead, it's obfuscated or tinted a particular way. So if we want to overcome ill will, what can we do? If we find that this is as a reason we have some longing, some ill will, there's a few things we can do. One is a little bit of what I touched on in the guided meditation. One is to just recognize, I have some ill will here. Sometimes that alone can be really powerful, just to name it, to recognize it, to say, here it is. And then as best we can we align with the reality of the moment? And that is, allow it to be there. It's legitimate because it is there. I'm not saying we're condoning it. I'm not saying that we're going to be completely passive about it. I'm not saying that we're going to suppress it. I'm saying we're just seeing what's actually there. And as best we can we allow it to be there without making it more complicated? Can we see it clearly? The third step is to feel in the body. This can be enormously helpful because to feel in the body is a way in which can slow down or minimize or somehow diminish the spinning that the mind can do. This making up the stories or going back coming back around to, making it worse and worse and worse. You know, sometimes we can work ourselves up into a lather about stings. So to feel it in the body, the physical sensation, and sometimes it's easier than if we can bring our awareness to the tightness in the chest, or kind of like the collapse, that feeling that sometimes goes with ill will, or there's often a lot of tension associated with ill will. So if we can bring our awareness to that, and sometimes it can be helpful to just relax that, to move from the body can have an effect on the mind. That's the third step, recognize, allow, feel. And the fourth is tease apart. Can we tease apart the ill will and our reaction to the ill will? Like, probably we want to be people who aren't filled with gross movements of ill will, which would be kind of on one end of the spectrum. Ill will is hatred and hostility. So maybe we would like to think of ourselves as kind and generous people. So it might be that when you notice, when you recognize there's some ill will, there's a little bit of a reaction, like, no, I don't want that to be there. Maybe there's a little bit of ill will towards the ill will. So can we tease apart and that's okay, so I'm having this experience of ill will and I'm noticing that I'm adding on to it. Sometimes just this recognition that these are two different things can help take some of the power away, can help take some of the energy or the movement away from it. Recognize, allow, feel, and tease apart. So when ill will arises. So ill will, and the story of this monk here, the cattle tying fig tree, is associated with stench. It's kind of maybe it's pervasive all around. This something that's decidedly unpleasant, though, at this word stench. And it attracts flies. And what are flies in this story? Flies are unhelpful thoughts, unskillful thoughts, unwholesome thoughts. I think this, of course, right, we've created all the conditions, if we're having a lot of ill will, for not the best version of ourselves to show up, but to something that maybe leads to unwise actions, that leads to further tension and collapsing and getting kind of consumed or compulsive or collapsed into this sense of ill will and not being able to see the bigger picture or that other possibilities exist. So maybe I'll stay there. I'll stop there with the Buddha saying, we could also use this word, don't pollute yourself. For if you pollute yourself, flies will attack one who has this stench, is filled with stench. Something like this. I don't have the exact words here. So maybe I'll open this up to some questions or comments.
This is interestingly appropriate and somewhat disconnected. I have a new hearing aid today, and you're almost unintelligible because there's a lot of artifacts that are just keep occurring. And as one can imagine, it's very frustrating to attempt to follow something that's got a bunch of garbage sounds in it. And as you began, I was noticing the frustration, but heaven be praised, no ill will.
Nice.
So, unpleasant experiences, just damned unpleasant. There isn't much one can do about the persistence of unpleasant experience. It's unpleasant enough without the pain, without the ill will.
That's right.
That could come along. Thank goodness for no ill will.
Yes, yes, thank goodness for that. Thank you, Lewis. Yeah, yeah. That's nice. I'm sorry that it was difficult for you to hear and spend time with that.
Me too. Mm.
Did you have ill will towards your hearing aid?
No, it's just, you know, a malfunctioning device that will be adjusted in due time. I don't even have ill will toward the calendar, which is not going to allow me to remedy the situation.
Nice, nice. Can we use that microphone?
Question. So, the origin of what this kind of process or movement that you've been describing is, it could be, as you said, what was it, a longing, or so some type of a desire or an aversion, right? And so that is frustrated, or somehow something is not working for you.
That's right.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, it seems like it's possible to have, you know, many emotions at that point, many different, you know, frustration potentially being one of them, anger, blind anger. anger directed or at someone or something. So I guess I'm just kind of probing around this idea of, or this kind of use of the term ill will, because it seems kind of, when you started talking about it, I was really kind of trying to get my mind around, what is this ill will? And so, anyway, I'm still not sure, because it seems like it could be many things, whereas ill will I think of as a kind of malign intent or something like that towards someone or something.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's the story works with any version of this. It includes some malevolence, but maybe it's just also some just old-fashioned aversion too. But right, the same thing is that when we allow ourselves to, if it's just a aversion, just kind of a wish for it not to be there, but no hostility, no malevolence or anything like that, we still kind of, we can kind of collapse around and think that, oh, I just have to fix this one thing, and we can't see the bigger picture anymore, and then we have thoughts that might be unskillful, partly because we don't see the bigger picture, and maybe because also frustration, right, is not our highest self, our best version of ourselves, when we're feeling frustrated. Yeah, thank you, Andrew.
This isn't very deep, but I have this image in my mind of the monks with their bowls, and all the children I passed on my way here with their little orange plastic pumpkins.
Going to the house to house.
House to house, looking for alms.
That's very sweet. kind of like it. Okay, so I'm wishing you all a happy Halloween, and may your longings not be thwarted. Thank you.